Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Holy Land Revisited. Pope Benedict recalls his pilgrimage to Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, and says throughout his visit he wanted to remind Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike of a commitment to promote peace. What Muslims really think. We find out why talk of an impending and inevitable clash of civilization between the West and the world's Muslims is not borne out by the findings of a major global study on interfaith relations. And Sri Lanka winning the peace. As the war ends, the Archbishop of Colombo and the Bishop of Jaffna in the predominantly Tamil area in the north speak about what needs to be done to rebuild the shattered nation and promote reconciliation. Benedict today recalled last week's pilgrimage to the Holy Land and says throughout his visit he wanted to remind Jews, Christians and Muslims alike of the commitment to promote peace. He was speaking at his Wednesday General Audience and Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Dear brothers and sisters,
speaking to over 30,000 pilgrims in a sun-drenched St. Peter's Square Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI gave his analysis of his recent pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
My recent apostolic journey to the Holy Land was a pilgrimage to the sources of our faith and a pastoral visit to the Christian communities in the lands of our Lord's birth, death, and resurrection.
The Pope retraced the journey, which took place from May 8th to 15th, step by step, stressing the respect for religious freedom he witnessed in Jordan, the importance of coexistence between Christians and Muslims, the universal warning of the Shoah, and the need for all believers to abandon prejudices and the desire to predominate. In Jordan, he recalled his visits to Mount Nebo and then Bethany beyond Jordan. Mount Nebo he described as a site of strong symbolic significance, which speaks of our condition as pilgrims. In Bethany, he blessed the foundation stones of two new churches. Pope Benedict underlined how this fact is a sign of the Kingdom of Jordan's respect for religious freedom and the Christian tradition. The Pope said he was given the occasion to express his recognition of this and his respect for Muslims in his visit to the Al-Hussein bin Talal Mosque in Amman. There, he also recalled those places where, still today, Christians live in difficult circumstances, such as nearby Iraq. Still in Jordan, Pope Benedict XVI recalled the inauguration of the Catholic University of Madaba, which he said tangibly manifests the Church's love for the search for truth and common good, an essential first step to dialogue between civilizations. On the 11th, he arrived in Israel, where from the very outset he presented himself as a pilgrim of peace.
Reminding Jews, Christians and Muslims alike of our commitment as believers in the one God to promote respect, reconciliation and cooperation in the service of peace. In Jerusalem, the city of peace, sacred to the followers of the three great monotheistic religions, this was a message I brought to the holy places, and particularly to the Western Wall and the Dome of the Rock.
A moment of intense contemplation marked his visit to Yad Vashem. Never, added the Pope, must we forget the tremendous tragedy of the Shoah. On the contrary, it must always be in our memory as a universal warning of the sacredness of human life, which always bears an infinite value.
My visit to the local churches culminated in the masses celebrated in Amman, Jerusalem, Bethlehem and Nazareth.
He reflected on the isolation, uncertainty and poverty, all of those things which have forced Christians to leave the Holy Land. But he also added, the Church continues its journey, witnessing the meaning of faith.
My pilgrimage ended in prayer on Calvary and before the Holy Sepulchre, the empty tomb, which continues to rather the message of hope for individuals and for the whole human family.
In the Holy Land, Pope Benedict said, despite wars and destruction and even conflicts between Christians, the Church continues in its mission and is on the road to full unity. On Mount Calvary and before the empty tomb, I invoked the power of love, the only power that guides history and the cosmos.
With gratitude for the many blessings of this pilgrimage, I ask you to join me in praying for the needs of the Church in the Near East and the gift of peace for the entire region.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Promoting better understanding between Jews, Christians and Muslims was one of the key objectives of Pope Benedict's pilgrimage last week to the Holy Land. It's also the aim of the Coexist Foundation, a British charity that seeks to promote this better understanding through education, dialogue and research. Especially in the wake of the September 11th attacks, fears of an impending clash of civilization between the largely Christian West and the world's Muslims have been stoked up by many a commentator in the international media. But is the West and the world's 1.3 billion Muslims really on a collision course? When the media searches for an answer to that contentious question, they usually overlook the actual views of Muslims themselves. Now the findings of a major global study of interfaith relations, just published by Gallup and the Coexist Foundation, help break down many of the myths and stereotypes about Muslim attitudes. The report's findings are based on thousands of interviews with residents in Muslim-majority countries and three Western nations that have significant Muslim populations. Henry Hogger is a former British diplomat with a career spent largely in Arab nations, including a posting as ambassador in Syria. He has been appointed by Gallup to help increase awareness among opinion leaders in Europe of the findings contained in the global study and of a separate poll among Muslim communities in London, Paris and Berlin. He spoke to my colleague Philippa Hitching about the surprising findings concerning the opinions and aspirations of Muslims today.
Well, just to take two or three examples, I suppose one which is interesting because it seems to contradict rather widely held perceptions in the Western media and in some quarters in Western society, which is that when they asked a pair of questions, the first of which was about attachment to religion, and in answer to a question essentially asking how important is religion in your daily life, they found that, as you might perhaps expect, that among the Muslims in the three countries there were relatively high percentages who said it was very important, around 80 or so percent, whereas among the general public, who were also asked as a comparator for this question, the values were a good deal lower, ranging from about 30 to about 25% in the three countries. They then asked separately about how strongly do you feel attached to your country, meaning your country of residence, so for French Muslims it would be France. And interestingly, in the three countries, as between, for example, French Muslims and the French public generally, the values were about the same, around 50 or so, slightly more percent. In Germany, rather lower in both cases. Interestingly, perhaps 32% of the general German public expressed strong attachment to the concept of Germany, and Muslim community slightly less. In Britain, it was actually 77% of British Muslims who said they felt strongly attached to their country, compared with 50% of the general British public. And the conclusion that seems to emerge from that is that the perception you often hear about, and indeed that emerged in answer to another question asked by the Gallup researchers, namely that Muslims in European countries are not loyal to their countries of residence, seems to be undermined by what they themselves say. And as I say, in the case of Britain specifically, even seems that the Muslims feel rather more loyalty than the general public as a whole.
This does fly in the face of what many people fear, doesn't it? That in some way Muslims coming over to our European countries simply don't want to integrate. They'd rather stay in ghettos, that there is a sort of breeding ground, if you will, for the more fundamentalist ideas.
It does, and so does another question, which I might just mention briefly, which was also asked, which was about the kind of community that people preferred to live in. So that the interviewees were asked, Would you rather live in a community consisting of people all of your own kind, ethnically and religiously and everything else, or a mixed community of a variety of different people of different backgrounds, or a community with none of your own kind in it? Once again, in all three countries, among the Muslims, there was a much higher vote of the order of 40 to 50% of people saying they'd rather live in a mixed community than there was among the general public as a whole in each of those countries. So in other words, as you rightly say, the widespread perception that Muslims come to Europe and want to live in isolated ghetto-type communities seems to be entirely at variance with what they themselves say. Obviously, there's a difference between where they say they'd prefer to live and where they do live in real life, which may be conditioned by economic or all sorts of other circumstances. But it's quite clear that in terms of the majority, at least in all three countries, there's a very strong preference for being part of the community rather than remaining isolated from it.
Who is responsible, do you think, for this rather distorted picture that so many of us have? Is there some kind of concerted campaign by the media, the politicians perhaps, to paint these Muslim immigrants to our countries as people who don't want to integrate? Mm.
I think it's very difficult to make judgments about that. The Gallup surveys, of course, are designed to put factual information into the public domain. So this is the voice of Muslims themselves, if you like, that is on the record here expressing certain views. And the hope of the sponsors of the project is that by putting that information into the public domain, one will be able to provide a more rational, factual-based starting point for what is in all our countries, I think, a very emotional debate that is full of misconceptions and other prejudices. I don't think I'm in a position to try and put a finger on anybody for deliberately spreading those misconceptions. I think they've grown up from a number of different misunderstandings, which perhaps reflect the fact that, for example, in the World Survey, Muslims themselves were very anxious to stress that they felt that Western societies didn't respect their culture, didn't have much understanding of their culture. And it may be that lack of comprehension is mutual, and that's what gives rise to a lot of the misperceptions. But as I mentioned, the principal interest of this project is to put this factual information, not about what somebody, an academic expert or some other self-styled community leader, says Muslims think, but what they actually think themselves when they're asked.
Do you think there is a problem, for example, within these European Muslim communities of a lack of clear leadership, a lack of figures to whom we can turn for this kind of information, these kinds of facts?
I think there is. I think there are perhaps two related reasons for that. As you know, I expect, in Islam, the, if you like, religious hierarchy is not as clear-cut as it is in most Christian communities and indeed other religious communities, in the sense that there isn't a priesthood as such. And there is, therefore, a bit of a vacuum in terms of finding people who can speak for the Muslim community as a whole in a given country. Also bear in mind that in all our countries, the Muslim community is very mixed of different ethnic origin. They come in Britain, for example, a large majority come from the subcontinent, from what are now India and Pakistan. In France, and I believe too in Italy, a majority come from the North African countries, Morocco and others. And in Germany, as you know, the immigrants of Muslim faith are probably mostly Turkish. So you've got a different makeup in each country of the community, and you'll have different factors conditioning who is deemed to speak for them. And there is perhaps another point, because in the very interesting discussions I've been able to have here in Italy with different representatives of different areas of life, if you like, there has been, I think it's been made very clear to me that there is a problem here about finding spokesmen for the Muslim community, in quotes, because it is diverse, it's made up of a number of different elements, and because in the religious hierarchy, as I say, there isn't a clear-cut system for having a spokesman, there are perhaps difficulties in finding valid interlocutors within that community.
What about the role of religion, the role of religious leaders in particular here?
Well, turning back perhaps to the World Poll, partly to comment on that, It's interesting that around the Muslim countries themselves, whether ones that are governed according to largely religious principles like Saudi Arabia or Iran or other more perhaps secular countries, you find that there's quite a large majority of people who say that they would like to see the Islamic law, the Sharia, as it's called, being a basis for legislation in their country, not the only basis, but a basis. But when they're asked if they would like to see religious leaders in charge of their government, there's a very large majority say no, thank you. And I think that's something that you can perhaps in some ways put across into the European context, in the sense that though, as we've already said, Muslims on the whole in Europe or elsewhere attach a very much higher degree of importance to their religion than many of us in Western societies perhaps these days, that's not the same as saying that they want to be governed according to religious principles or by religious leaders. Yes, they have a much stronger attachment to what we might call, with a small c, conservative moral values, and you'll see that in some of the answers to questions on moral issues where the Muslim view is much more restrictive, let's say, than among the general public as a whole. But I don't think that's a sign that, as I say, they want to be governed according to religious principles. I think they would see, there's no specific question in the survey about this, but they would see the role of religious leaders in their communities in Europe as being unifying, representational, to act as a voice with government and other authorities and interlocutors that they need to talk to, rather than being the people to whom they would always look for guidance in how they live their daily lives. That's an impression I have, rather outside the survey. But
moving away a moment from the poll to your own experience, as you say, you've spent a lot of your career in largely Muslim countries. How concerned are you about what we've come to call this clash of civilizations, or how optimistic are you, if you want to put it in a different way, that these barriers, these prejudices, if you like, are being slowly overcome?
The normal thing that diplomats say when they're asked a question like that is that they're cautiously optimistic. I'm a little bit more than cautiously optimistic, actually, about this. In the book that's been produced by Gallup to summarise the World Poll, which is co-authored by two very respected American experts on Islam and on Middle Eastern affairs, Dalia Mugahid, who is an American lady of Egyptian background, who works with the other author, John Esposito, who's a well-known American academic specialising in those issues. They conclude, although, as we've already said, the purpose of this survey and this project is simply to put information into the public domain, that doesn't stop the authors drawing certain conclusions, one of which is precisely that there is nothing inevitable about the clash of civilizations. There is, for example, no evidence from these surveys that there's any inbuilt incompatibility between the religion of Islam and the principle of democracy. As I said, I think at the beginning, when Muslims are asked what they most admire about Western society, one of the first things they talk about is democracy and freedom of speech. When they're asked even about whether they would like more democracy in their own countries, the majority say yes, they would. They regard that as being something that would improve their own lives. So on that one particular principle, and we've already talked about attitudes towards violence, for example, there doesn't seem to be, from any of this information, any real indication that there's some inevitable conflict looming between our two civilizations. Indeed, sometimes worth remembering, and I'm going back to my own experience and, if you like, knowledge, that a lot of what we take for granted as an integral part of our Western and European culture these days, coming through from the Renaissance, starting as it did in Italy, was actually transmitted from the ancient earlier cultures of the Greeks and the Romans through scholars in the Muslim and Arab world who translated this material from the Greek or the Latin into Arabic, where it was retranslated during the period of the Islamic conquests of some parts of Western Europe. So we actually owe, in other words, some of what we take for granted as part of our civilization to the very people and communities who with whom some people would like to think we're now on the road to conflict. It doesn't seem very logical to me.
In many of our Western countries, though, most people would be quite surprised by what you've just said, wouldn't they? There's a lot of ignorance about the cultural history of the relationship between these two groups of people, if you like.
And I think that's something, I agree with you entirely, I think that's something that is particularly borne in on you if you live in a country like Syria, for example, where I did for 3 years, or Jordan for 3 years, a little while before that, which are, after all, even we call it the Near East. I mean, there are neighbours. If and when, and it's probably a matter of when, for example, Turkey becomes a member of the European Union, the European Union will have a border with Syria, with Iraq, with countries that we, many people in the West and in Europe, think of as rather remote, oriental and mysterious places, are actually our neighbours. They're going to have, they do have in many cases already, trade agreements with the European Union. Our history is completely intertwined, not always for the better, because if you think of periods like the Crusades or the Muslim conquests or the Ottoman conquests of some parts of Europe, there is a history of conflict as well as cooperation. But on the whole, it's very difficult to separate the history or indeed the culture of our two regions. And anything such as the information that comes from the Gallup poll that reduces the tendency to think of our two religions, our two regions, our two civilizations being headed for some inevitable conflict, in my view at least, can only be valuable.
Former British diplomat Henry Hogger speaking to Philippa Hitchin. In Sri Lanka, the president has declared victory in the government's long-standing civil war against Tamil Tiger rebels. But how easy will it be to win the peace and achieve reconciliation with the island's minority Tamils? That's the question many are now asking in the wake of the government's military victory on the battlefields of northern Sri Lanka. More than 250,000 Tamils were displaced during the final offensive that led to the rebels' defeat. Many of them have been housed in overcrowded government-run camps in the north. So what role can the Catholic Church, whose members in Sri Lanka come from both the Sinhalese majority and the Tamil minority, play in rebuilding bridges on this war-torn island? The Archbishop of Colombo, Oswald Thomas Gomez, is Sinhalese, and he was asked by Ema McCarthy what now needs to be done to build the peace.
We are indeed very happy that the war is ended and that the government's security forces have been able to release all the innocent civilians who were trapped in battle. I also offer my deepest sympathies to those who laid down their lives in battle and those innocent civilians killed, trapped in war. In a sense, we could say that we have won the battle, but the war is not ended. The war would end only on the day that we grow in nationhood, realizing that we are all one people in one country with equal right. We have to realize the fact that we are a multi-ethnic, multi-religious and multicultural community. As such, we are now left with the great task of nation building, forgetting our ethnic, political and religious differences.
Now, of course, the church in Sri Lanka and particularly the church in the area have always been committed to promoting national unity, reconciliation and peace for the Tamil and for the Sinhalese populations together. What particular role does the Catholic Church have to play now in Sri Lanka? What can you give to the nation that perhaps no one else can give?
Immediately, we are sending a lot of relief for these people by way of material goods, namely food items, clothing and shelter. And we are also cooperating with the government to send some of these things. And thereafter, we will have to work a process of reconciliation, and already some of our nuns and others, volunteer workers, are there to look after the sick and those who have been injured, plus those who are without shelter and suffering and so on. So there are already our volunteer workers who are working there. We will continue this process because we have told the president that we are offering our services in this direction.
Now the media speaks of really hundreds of thousands of men, women and children who are now facing no homes, who they've nowhere to go, who have been affected by this war. Can you just describe for our listeners?
They have been shifted to different camps, and several foreign countries have offered them tents and so on. Now, I don't say they're in absolute comfort, but arrangements are being made quickly to accommodate them. And as early as possible, they'll be released to go to their own homes.
That's very important, isn't it?
Very much, because we have, personally, I met the president himself and told him that please arrange for these people to get back to their territories and start their work, especially their people of agriculture, farmers, and they would be happy if they can get back.
Finally, Archbishop Gomez, what are your hopes now for the future of Sri Lanka, of this island, which is heaven on earth from, you know, from a point of view of its natural beauty, but that has been wrecked so much by this war? What are your hopes for its future?
Yes. Actually, there are a whole lot of nuns who have gone there to work. Now, what I'm now answering your question directly, what we are doing now is somehow to work out a political solution to the problem. In fact, the president himself mentioned two very, very valid points. Number one, he said, hereafter, there is no minority and majority in Sri Lanka. We are all one nation. He said there are only two different kinds of people in Sri Lanka, that is, those who love the country and those who don't. But for all other differences, we are not to reckon them. So that was a great statement. Second thing, he said, we will find a political solution of our own that will give everyone equal right in the country.
The city of Jaffna in the north of Sri Lanka is in an area that was for a long time seen as the heartland of the Tamil Tigers insurgency. The local Catholic bishop, Thomas Savandaranayagam, who is himself a Tamil, spoke to us about his hopes following the government's defeat of the rebels.
This has been a very costly war because a lot of people have died and a lot of people have been displaced. And till the last, the Tamil Tigers were holding on to the people as space for them, safeguard for them. And so a lot of these people have suffered very much. Therefore, this has been a very costly, and more than about 300,000 displaced people is at the hands of the government. And now it is their great responsibility to look after these people who have undergone lot of suffering in this place called Vanni under the Tigers with various privations and also limitations. Therefore, government must try all their effort to provide them with shelter, then all the necessities of life, especially medical help, so that they are restored back to good health. That is the first thing the government has to do, and this will be winning hearts and mind if they do that. And if they neglect this one, of course, they will get the enmity of the people.
But what role can the church play in helping to promote peace and reconciliation after so many decades of bitter conflict?
The church has been always with the suffering people, even in these times of displacement. Therefore, they continue their services to the displaced people in the different camps and look after the pastoral needs. Also, the church, since it comprises of the Sinhalese and the Tamils, they must work towards a just solution to the problem.
That was the Bishop of Jaffna, Thomas Savandaranayagam.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.